From the studios of NPR West, this is Day to Day. I'm Madeline Brand.
And I'm Alex Cohen. Coming up, a chemical used to make flat-screen TVs and computers is 17,000 times more harmful than carbon dioxide.
But first, it is the largest outbreak of salmonella poisoning in 10 years. More than 1,000 people have become ill. Several hundred had to go to the hospital. Originally, tomatoes were the culprit. Now, federal health officials aren't so sure. NPR's Allison Aubrey is following this story. And Allison, so now I gather jalapeno peppers are under suspicion. Why is it that federal officials can't pinpoint where the salmonella outbreak came from?
Hi, Madeline. That's right. The jalapeno peppers are under suspicion. And they don't know for sure because they haven't been able to trace the bacteria back to a particular spot, to a farm or to a processing center. And so they've had to rely on interviews with people who've gotten sick to get their best clues. Now, early on in the first set of interviews, people reported eating a lot of tomatoes at a much higher rate than healthy people who weren't getting sick. So that was their early clue. Now, recently, they've got two clusters of people who've gotten sick, people exposed at the same time and same place who've reported eating jalapeno peppers.
So maybe this is something, a mixture of tomatoes and jalapenos?
It's very possible that there was some kind of crossover. Yesterday during a press call with FDA investigators, they basically say they don't know, but it's possible that both of these foods are implicated. Neither tomatoes nor jalapeno peppers explain the whole outbreak.
So I imagine that the people who actually grow these foods, the farmers who grow the tomatoes and the jalapeno peppers and maybe other produce, are kind of worried that, you know, people just say, you know, I'm not going to buy any fruits and vegetables for a while because I don't know where my food is coming from and I don't know if it's going to make me sick.
Yeah, tomato growers certainly have lost a lot of sales. Many have had to plow under their fields and leave their crop to rot. So the latest numbers are that the losses across the supply chain top $100 million. So certainly there's concern there. Perhaps they feel that they've been singled out unfairly since there's never been a direct trail, you know, back to a specific tomato or, you know, a farm source.
So what is the FDA to do to balance the growers' concerns with our concerns about healthy food?
Well, this came up yesterday, again, during this press call. The FDA's top investigator on this case said that, of course, he's heard the criticisms. The point he made is this, that in the case of tomatoes, they waited until they had very sound evidence pointing to tomatoes. You know, by the time they issued the warning to avoid certain types, they'd interviewed many people who'd gotten sick. They'd given them detailed food questionnaires, and they found that up to 80% of them had reported eating the kinds of tomatoes implicated. So there was good evidence, and they point out, hey, it's our job to protect the public. And when we have good evidence, it's our job to come out with that. And all along the way, they have been saying, look, we need more authority to step in and perhaps require traceback systems with fresh produce.
So is it possible, Allison, that we'll never know really where the salmonella bacteria came from?
You know, it's very possible. The problem with fresh produce is that by the time people get sick from the salmonella bacteria, the produce is either eaten, rotten, or thrown out.
So what are we to do when we go to the grocery store and look at vegetables? Should we eye them all with a wary eye?
I don't think so. I think the advisories are very specific. We have two advisories, one on tomatoes, one on peppers. With tomatoes, it's not changing. The FDA is still warning people not to eat Roma, Plum, or red round tomatoes unless they're certain that they were grown in these areas that have been excluded from the investigation. And many grocery stores have now posted notes to this effect. With peppers, I'm sure we'll start to see the notes soon. And the important thing to note here is that the outbreak is still ongoing. There are still 30 to 40 people getting sick or new cases being reported every day.
NPR's Allison Aubrey, thank you.
Thanks, Madeline.
Next, something consumers should consider when buying a TV or computer. The conventional wisdom is that flat screens are better for the environment because they save energy. Well, that may be true, but it turns out that a chemical commonly used to make those products is 17,000 times more damaging than carbon dioxide to the atmosphere. And yet, nitrogen trifluoride, or NF3, is not regulated like other greenhouse gases. It's a concern raised by Michael Prather. He's director of the UC Irvine Environment Institute, and he joins us now. Thanks for talking with us. And could you begin by explaining what exactly is NF3 and how it's used?
NF3 is one nitrogen and three fluorine atoms. It's stuck together in a compound like ammonia, and it's a gas, only synthetic. We don't find it in the environment unless we make it. It's used to scrub and clean the room and evacuate the chambers between making basically computer chips or big LCD flat screens.
That number, 17,000 times more potent than CO2, it sounds pretty scary. Can you put it into some context for us?
Well, a carbon dioxide molecule floats around in the atmosphere for 75 to a couple hundred years, and it absorbs infrared light from the planet because it has these bands which stretch, so CO2 acts as a greenhouse gas. It sort of acts as our greenhouse blanket. Nitrogen trifluoride has even stronger bands, and it lasts 500 years or more in the atmosphere, and therefore it has a much stronger greenhouse warming potential.
And how exactly does this NF3 get into the atmosphere from these products?
To be fair, people should not panic. This is not in your product. This is used in the manufacture of your product. The problem with NF3 is that if you don't destroy it, it gets into the atmosphere. When I read Air Products, I was very proudly bragging that they had replaced this greenhouse gas with a new gas called NF3, which was good for the environment. It's not good for the environment, and we've known it at least for a decade, but it's never been produced in major quantities. And so suddenly it was becoming an industrial commodity.
This gas is not covered by the Kyoto Protocol, which is the international treaty that regulates many greenhouse gases. Why doesn't it cover NF3?
In 1995-96, I wrote a chapter on atmospheric chemistry and greenhouse gases with about five other co-authors, and we were listing all the gases we knew that were greenhouse gases, and we didn't even know about NF3. In 1995-96 was the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change assessment that was used to set up the Kyoto Protocol. Not only did nitrogen trifluoride not make it in, but production was so low that it was really a minor gas. In 2001, we put it in the chapter, and it got noted duly, but there were no estimates of production. Nobody's measured it in the atmosphere. It wasn't worth revising the government negotiations. Same thing happened in 2007 last year. Once again, nobody realized the level of production, and it didn't fit in the other niches.
If you're a consumer, you're hearing all of this and you want to buy a TV or a computer, what should you do?
I would say you really have to go for it for now because it's up to the companies, the chemical industry, and the big manufacturers. They're the ones who are going to have to find another route out of this. This is sort of a wake-up call that technology always has its price, and we should really be looking at sort of a whole systems analysis of what it's doing in the environment.
Michael Prather is the director of the UC Irvine Environment Institute. Thank you.
Thank you, Alex.
And now for something really scary, serial killers. In movies and TV shows, serial killers are almost always white males, loner types who are insane and like to leave clues for the authorities.
Good evening, Clary.
He doesn't want us to cut through our chains. He wants us to cut through our feet.
Maybe he's trying to share the responsibility of these murders with us. If we don't figure out the clues in time, the blood's on our hands.
Do you have any idea how crazy you are?
You mean the nature of this conversation?
I mean the nature of you.
A new report from the FBI says serial killers are not the kind of people you think they are, and definitely not what you see in the movies and on TV. We're joined now by Bob Morton. He's a special agent with the FBI. Is there any damage done by that stereotype being out there?
Well, law enforcement is part of the same community that consumes the entertainment industry like everybody else. So what happens is because of the rarity of these cases, an investigator or a detective, the serial case that he's working on may be the only one he ever does. And so you relate it to things that you've been exposed to. The entertainment industry very obviously has exposed us to a number of things about serial murder that aren't necessarily true.
Was there ever a profile that the FBI has used in the past to look for serial killers?
There's not a single profile for any serial killer. That's one of the myths that comes out of books in Hollywood. Every serial killer was a white male that looked like Ted Bundy and was chasing women who had dark hair parted in the middle. In reality, what we always tried to do was to look at each individual crime or series of crimes by itself and try to establish some personality traits of the offender that would be committing those crimes.
Let's take a look at what you did find. When you see killers portrayed in the movies, they often leave little clues, you know, ways that the police can actually find out who they are. They say, you know, they want to get caught. Does that happen in real life?
If they really wanted to get caught, they would walk into the police station and say, for example, I'm the BTK killer. That didn't happen. People aren't good at what they do, and they make mistakes, and those are the kind of things that law enforcement uses to catch offenders.
There's also the stereotype of the dysfunctional loner. serial killer. How accurate is that?
It's not accurate across the board for serial killers. There's a number of recent examples where you see people like Dennis Rader, who was married the whole time he was committing his crimes. On the outward side, a model citizen, a good father, a person who took a lot of interest in his children, someone who lived next door to you.
Your report mentions that much like this country, serial killers come in all races and colors, but it seems like a lot of the examples in this report are men. Are serial killers more often men than women?
Yes, they are more often men. It's an area that hasn't been studied a great deal. There have been women who do commit serial murder. They don't normally do it for the same reasons that men do it, for example, sexually motivated serial killers.
There's also this notion portrayed in Hollywood that the serial killer can't stop killing. Is that true?
No. There's a number of examples out there of people that have stopped for quite a long time. And that's usually based not on a sense of remorse, but this kind of activity takes a great deal of time out of your day. Because of that and the commitment to other things, a lot of times these people just, they stop doing it.
Mr. Morton, the way that you describe serial killers in real life, it sounds like they could pretty much be anybody. So how do you, as an FBI agent, how do you look for them?
Oh, I look for them based upon what they do at a crime scene, how they interact with the victim, what they do to the victim, how they choose the victim, how they dispose of the victim's body. You look at every single thing about why they would choose who they choose and kind of go from there.
Bob Morton is a special agent with the FBI talking to us about the new report on serial killers. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
This is Day to Day. I'm Alex Cohen.
And I'm Madeline Brand. Earlier this week on the program, we spoke with an official with the World Anti-Doping Agency. He said there would be a lot more aggressive testing for performance-enhancing drugs at the Olympics next month. But there are drugs and methods of enhancing athletic performance that can elude testing. And here with more is NPR science correspondent John Hamilton. Hi, John. What are these drugs we're talking about?
Well, there are a whole range of them. One of them is a drug called THG. It's a designer steroid. And this gets to the thing that to find something, to test for something, you have to know what it is. And athletes used this drug literally for years before it was tested for. And that's because they had to actually find the drug before they could develop a test for it. So that's one reason that you can easily elude a test. The other thing is that more and more athletes are using substances that are actually made by the body. So, for instance, EPO, which creates more red blood cells, or human growth hormone, which can help develop muscles, these are actually produced in the body itself. And it's very hard to tell the synthetic version that you inject into somebody from the version that the body makes itself.
What are the anti-doping agencies of the world supposed to do about this?
What they have done is every year they get more and more sophisticated tests. They have, you know, million-dollar mass spectrometers now that can detect tiny portions. They can see the signature of a synthetic EPO, for example. But it's really kind of an arms race. And you know, for every time that they ramp up their ability to detect, you have laboratories and athletes who are coming up with more and more sophisticated ways to evade these tests or products that are unlikely to be caught. And if you just look at the money behind it, you know, the World Anti-Doping Agency has a budget of 20-something million dollars a year. Well, heck, there are athletes who make more than that, just one of them, in a year. So it's really not a fair fight.
So is there a technology race? Are people trying to come up with technology as quickly as possible?
There's a race on both sides. And when you look out on the horizon, for instance, you see a lot of people talking about what they call gene doping. And this is where you actually use a virus to introduce a new gene into somebody's body that will do something beneficial, at least from a sporting point of view, like create more muscle. So right now, I was just talking to a guy who's developed something that affects a protein called myostatin that controls the amount of muscle mass. And you can inject a gene into a specific specific muscle that will affect the myostatin in such a way that the muscle will develop more. And there is absolutely no sign of anything circulating in the blood or urine. So no test that they do at the Olympics today or at any other sporting event would detect this.
That's amazing. And who's behind this? Who's financing all this?
Well, I mean, if you look at the Balco scandal, this is the Bay Area laboratory that was involved with a number of elite athletes, including Marion Jones. And if you look at who's financing it, what you have is an underground pharmaceutical world where there are laboratories that serve the elite athletes who have the money to purchase this stuff.
So basically, we're just going to look at these races and think everyone's somehow enhanced?
I talked to one doping expert who said, he said, when I watch events, I try to remember that somewhere, somehow, sometime, there is actually an athlete who's going to break a record who's not doping. But that's the exception.
We'll never know for sure.
We'll never know.
NPR science correspondent John Hamilton, thank you.
You're welcome.
One nation to watch next month at the Olympics is Spain. This summer has been a great time to be a Spanish sports fan. Spain took the European Cup Soccer Championship. A Spaniard took the Wimbledon Cup. And the country's team is racing very well this week in the Tour de France. From a euphoric Madrid, Jerome Sokolowski reports.
There's a tune on the lips of nearly every child in Spain these days. They're singing the national soccer team's fighting song with extra verve now after Spain won its first Euro Soccer Cup in 44 years and a Spaniard won Wimbledon for the first time in 42 years.
Marca Madrid, más líder de la liga, 9 de la primera, gol de Yumandi, del Madrid, Ronaldo!
Spain has always been a sports-crazy nation, especially when it comes to soccer. And it's not as though Spaniards haven't done well before. In the 70s and 80s, Seve Ballesteros was at the top of the golf circuit, and cyclist Miguel Indurain won 5 Tour de France years before Lance Armstrong stood on the podium. But those Spanish champions were few and far between. These days, Nadal and the soccer team are part of a cast of stars that includes Formula One driver Fernando Alonso, LA Lakers player Pau Gasol, and the Tour de France defending champion Alberto Contador. In a country where the biggest newspapers are sports dailies, the reporters are busy these days.
Diario AS?
Diario AS is one of the most popular papers in Spain. Its deputy chief editor, Luis Nieto, says Spain is finally fulfilling its potential.
Este es un país que tiene muy buen clima, es decir, para la práctica del deporte prácticamente se puede hacer todo el año.
This is a country with great weather for sports. The only thing missing was real facilities for its athletes, he says. But since Spain became a democracy in the 70s, sports complexes have been built, even in small towns and villages. And even the country roads have now been paved. An afternoon drive out of the city takes you past packs of cyclists all zipping along the roads like they were in France or Holland. Nieto says Spain's young sports stars have benefited from the new infrastructure. These are the first who didn't have to make their way across the city to train. They have good facilities, coaches, and sports doctors at their doorstep, he says. A trainer coaches 19-year-old Lenica de Simon at the Sports Ministry's High Performance Training Center in Madrid. De Simon was born in the United States and moved here at the age of 13. Spain may have come a long way, but she says the sporting culture is still not up to par with the United States.
It's totally different. There's a lot more girls who do gymnastics. It's a lot more popular sport in the United States. Here it's not as popular. Here it's soccer, and more soccer.
But Spaniards are starting to take an interest in other sports, especially as the Olympics draw near. After all, the soccer team didn't qualify for Beijing. Spain's best Olympic hopes are in basketball, handball, tennis, and cycling. For NPR News, I'm Jerome Sokolowski in Madrid.
This is Day to Day. I'm Madeline Brand.
And I'm Alex Cohen. In a few minutes, Vacationing Closer to Home, we launch a new summer series.
But first, a professional group of African-American doctors says it accepts the apology from the American Medical Association. The AMA today issued a formal apology for discriminating against African-American doctors and not allowing them to join the AMA. That exclusion led black doctors to form their own group many years ago, the National Medical Association. And Dr. Nelson Adams is president of the NMA. He's here now. Dr. Adams, welcome to the program.
Thank you. I'm glad to be a part of it.
First, before we get to this issue of the apology and your acceptance of it, please tell us, what was your own experience? Did you encounter discrimination when you became a doctor?
Certainly not to the extent that took place generations before me, and actually just a few years before me. By the time I came along, there was residual, but the doors were essentially open if you were properly credentialed.
Well, so you accept the apology, but with some conditions, I understand.
There's three things that I think we all have to begin to focus on. Number one, back in 1980, when Margaret Heckler was Secretary of HHS, she produced a report, and one of the findings there was that it was clear that a commonness between the provider and the patient often impacted in a positive way on the outcome. So number one, we need collaboration to actively recruit more African-Americans into the medical profession. There are fewer African-American physicians per capita today than there were at the very beginning of the 1900s. In 1910, we actually had more African-American physicians per capita than we do today.
That's sure. That's a shocking statistic, or surprising statistic. Can you flesh that out a little bit?
In the early 1900s, there were more than 20 medical schools, actually, that focused on the training of blacks. And shortly thereafter, because of many things, including institutionalized racism, these schools went the way of the dinosaur. So this diminution in the number of opportunities for training was a big part of that. Those trends continue today, and with some of the actions that have been taken in recent years as related to affirmative action and the like, have also had a negative impact.
And so what you're saying is that the result of that is that African-American patients receive substandard care and are more prone to diseases like heart disease, diabetes, et cetera?
Well, the two are certainly linked. The second point really deals with what you just talked about, and that's this whole issue of health disparities. A commitment to reduce health disparities among African-Americans and other communities of color is a must. The AMA and the NMA and other groups who came together a few years ago to form a commission to end health disparities. And that's a great first step, but much work needs to be done there. And we need a full commitment from all of us to do something about health disparities. I'm saddened to say that the health of Americans is poor. We are in the lower quartile of health status of all industrialized countries. So for us to say we want to get to the point where white America is really not the point. All of America is in pretty bad shape as it relates to our health. A rising tide raises all of the ships, and indeed we need to raise the tide of the health status of our people, not just some of us, but all of us. And the third point, which I think is extremely important, is as it relates to how you deal with patients, this whole notion of what's called cultural competency has to be raised up. And this basically means communication. We suggest that the AMA and NMA work together to provide for a requirement for medical schools and medical licensing to make cultural competency mandatory.
Dr. Adams, you are the head of the National Medical Association. Why not merge your group with the AMA and make it stronger that way?
Well, you know, many of us are members of both organizations. I've been a member off and on of AMA for more than 20 years. I've been a member of NMA for 20-plus years. And the reason is simple. It's a matter of perspective. No one will focus on the concerns of our community, the African-American community, that is, like African-Americans. It's pretty plain, pretty basic. The disparities that exist are there because the attention has not been given.
Dr. Adams, thank you very much.
Thank you.
We've been talking about the AMA's formal apology for years of discrimination with Dr. Nelson Adams, president of the African American Medical Group, the National Medical Association. Less swag for doctors when NPR's Day to Day continues. Back now with Day to Day. Many doctors have piles of Viagra notepads and Lipitor pens in their offices. Now the drug industry is announcing new guidelines restricting gifts aimed at marketing new products. Some critics say it's a positive step, but it does not go far enough. Marketplace's Bob Moon is here now. Bob, what kinds of problems will be addressed by these new guidelines, solved by these guidelines, and, well, what won't these guidelines cover?
Hey, Madeline. What we're talking about here, as you mentioned, is just the tchotchkes, those ubiquitous little freebies that you often see in the doctor's office. This voluntary code is being announced by the industry's trade association, the Pharmaceutical Research and Manufacturers of America, and they're suggesting these limits on gifts as a growing number of states crack down on these things because they say it might influence the drugs that doctors prescribe their patients. This code doesn't address, though, some of the more lucrative arrangements that a lot of doctors have with drug companies, and industry critics say banning some trinkets isn't going to solve this problem here. We spoke a short time ago to Sharon Treat. She's the executive director of the National Legislative Association on Prescription Drug Prices.
They're a symbol of what's wrong right now with the way marketing is done and with the way the drug industry deals with these issues. The problem is that there are a lot of much more serious issues and a lot of spending that goes on that has a very direct and pernicious effect on the practice of medicine and marketing in general. And I think those are things that the industry ought to also look at.
This new code calls for annual limits on what the drug companies pay doctors to deliver educational lectures, but it doesn't say what those limits should be, and it doesn't limit office breakfasts or lunches or trips to fancy restaurants for quote-unquote educational dinners.
Well, what kind of money does the drug industry pay doctors?
Well, just yesterday, the Attorney General of Vermont released a report on drug marketing there, and it found that drug makers give the most money to psychiatrists, and in particular, 11 psychiatrists there got an average of almost $57,000 each. Some states have passed restrictions that require drug makers to disclose what they're giving doctors, but quite often these speaking fees and consulting relationships are a different matter.
Well, I know there are several proposals on the table in various states to regulate drug marketing. Is this going to be enough to head off those regulations?
As it happens, industry critic Sharon Treat told us that that's just what she is concerned about. She says it might keep Congress and the states from doing anything serious.
Anything, you know, of this nature, which takes a very small part of the problem and says, okay, we've tackled the problem, you know, we're going to clean up our act, may be designed to prevent or discourage states and others from taking much stronger action that might be more effective.
But the industry says this code fortifies its commitment to ensure that medicines are marketed in a manner that benefits patients and enhances the practice of medicine.
Thank you, Bob. That's Bob Moon of Public Radio's Daily Business Show, Marketplace. This is Day to Day. I'm Madeline Brand.
And I'm Alex Cohen. With airlines cutting flights and the cost of plane tickets on the rise, many Americans are sticking close to home. Throughout this summer, we'll tell you about tourist destinations that aren't too far away. And if you're looking for something a bit different, you might want to check out the more than 8,000 destinations at roadsideamerica.com. The website lists all sorts of places, things like the world's largest burger in Clearfield, Pennsylvania, the Unclaimed Baggage Museum in Scottsboro, Alabama, and the Grotto of Redemption in West Bend, Iowa. Doug Kirby is the publisher of Roadside America, and he joins us now. Let's start off with the really hard-hitting question. Just how big is the world's biggest burger?
Well, that's actually a burger you can go and buy. The largest is 123 pounds, made at Denny's Pub in Clearfield, Pennsylvania. You actually have to give them a call a few days in advance for them to cook that one up. We chickened out. I think we only ordered the 15-pounder, and that took them 4 hours to cook. And we ate just a little of it, and then we actually carried it with us to Pittsburgh, trying to take it into the Big Mac Museum over that McDonald's run.
How do they feel about that?
They didn't go along with that idea.
You guys have been doing this for many years now. What are some of your favorite, weirdest recommendations?
Well, there's a fellow in Felicity, California, who runs a place called the Center of the World. Jacques Histel, and he just decided to make this property he owned into a town and declared it the center of the world. And he's actually had it notarized by the French government that it is, in fact, the center of the world. But he's built all kinds of interesting monuments out there. There's a pyramid where you can go in and stand on the center of the world, and you're given an official certificate that you've done that act. In Topeka, Kansas, there's a place called Truckhenge, Stonehenge made out of trucks turned up on one end.
And excellent.
Stuck into cement. And that's part of a long chain of, there's Carhenge and Foamhenge and all kinds of other henges around the United States.
I'm heading to Ann Arbor, Michigan this weekend, and I will have a rental car. Any places I should check out?
The world's largest tire, that's right near the airport. Gigantic tire that was in the 1964-65 New York World's Fair. Somehow, I guess they rolled it back to Michigan. There's also the world's largest stove is right near there. And the Henry Ford Museum. It's a more of a mainstream museum, but it's so giant, it's got a lot of little weird oddities, including a test tube that contains Thomas Edison's last breath.
Very cool. These are, of course, roadside destinations, which means you got to get in your car oftentimes to get to them. And I'm wondering, you know, nowadays with people being more concerned about carbon emissions and gas prices being so high, can you give us a few recommendations for places to go that won't cost you a lot?
One thing we found is a lot of times you get into a town, maybe for something like a little monument or statue, and then you'll find there's actually a local museum right there on the town square. And we really recommend that because, first of all, it's a boost to these towns. And one great one we went to was in Delphos, Kansas. It was the monument to Grace Bedell, who was a little girl who wrote a letter to Abe Lincoln suggesting that he grow a beard before the Civil War. So we went there to see that monument and noticed a little museum and went in. We found that the town had actually had a UFO landing, a famous Indian kidnapping, and a wolf girl used to wander the town. A triple extra bonanza on just that one museum.
Doug Kirby is the publisher of RoadsideAmerica.com. Thanks, Doug.
You're welcome.
What will you be driving on your mini road trip vacations this summer?
A 97 Nissan Sentra.
How about a 77 Volvo sedan?
A brand spanking new Ford Expedition.
Or my personal favorite, a 1984 Mercedes-Benz 300 turbo diesel that runs on veggie oil.
Your awesome auto, Madeline. Don't forget to mention the fabulous color.
Gold!
Now, what does your car say about you? For many of us, our car is an extension of our personality.
Black Honda Accord Hybrid equals what? Conservative dresser?
That 77 Volvo driver probably has a pair of Birkenstocks in the closet.
And more stereotypes. Hummer drivers crave the spotlight.
Break all these stereotypes. Send us a photo of you and your car together. Tell us why you drive it and what it says about you.
Go to npr.org/daydreaming.
Okay, no matter what you drive, you still have to buy gas, right? KQED's Rob Schmitz brings us this story about what tourist attractions in Southern California are doing to court people scared off by high gas prices.
Costa Mesa is in the heart of Orange County, just south of Los Angeles. It serves as a base camp for tourists who want to enjoy local attractions like Disneyland. Lately, though, it's been quiet here. At the city's Westin Hotel, it's so quiet that the Muzak, gently flowing from overhead speakers in the lobby, is the only sound on this recent morning. Michael Mustafa, director of sales and marketing, blames a slow economy and high gas prices.
The business has slowed considerably. The corporate group travel, the conventioneer business has slowed.
This downturn has prompted the city's Conference and Visitor Bureau to start paying people to come here. Mustafa says visitors now receive $25 dining coupons for each day they stay here and a $25 check for gas.
And we've actually upped that. If you stay three nights with us, we'll give you $50 gas credit because $25 wasn't even working. So, you know, pretty soon we're going to give you $100 back.
Costa Mesa isn't the only place offering to pay for your gas. Up the coast, Santa Barbara is doing the same thing. Susan Wilcox is a spokeswoman for the California Travel and Tourism Commission.
I think that travelers are going to be more mindful than in the past of their gas consumption and maybe look into going to places that are close that they've maybe wanted to visit or heard about visiting and haven't really taken advantage of up until now.
A survey released last month by the Travel Industry Association seems to confirm this. It found that 40% of Americans were planning to change their travel plans this summer to more local destinations because of high gas prices. And here in Southern California, one popular local destination is all too happy to accommodate.
5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
Roller coaster riders scream at the top of their lungs on a recent Monday afternoon at Disneyland. Gabriel Sanabria has been waiting in line at the ride for about an hour, which is, coincidentally, about how long it took him and his girlfriend to drive here from San Diego. Sanabria says the high gas prices will keep him coming back to local attractions like Disneyland, but he says he'll be changing his method of travel to more far-flung places he usually drives to.
You know, it's a common thing to go from San Diego to Vegas in your car from, you know, for San Diegans, so definitely fly more often. And I have a family in Northern California, so definitely flying, there's no question, I wouldn't even consider driving.
And of course, there isn't a guarantee airline prices won't change either. A spokesman for Disneyland wouldn't comment on how the rising price of gas has affected ticket sales. Disney traditionally keeps attendance figures secret. But on this day, the park is packed. Tim Rottenberg's been here for 6 hours, and he's only been able to enjoy 3 rides. He lives just miles away. He says he's been to the park dozens of times. As crowds bump past him on Disney's Main Street, the 18-year-old retains an almost existentialist take on how crowded it is today.
It's the concept of escapism, where people just want to come to Disneyland and get away. More and more people are doing it. Disneyland becomes another place where there's too many people, it costs more and more to get here, and you can't even find a place to escape to anymore from these gas prices, from things like that.
But for the time being, Disneyland will do its best to serve as an escape to a more local audience traveling fewer miles to get there. It is a small world, after all. For NPR News, I'm Rob Schmitz in Los Angeles.
Back now with Day to Day. The Blue Man Group has wowed audiences from Las Vegas to Amsterdam. Some 12 million fans have seen the show. It's three men, painted blue, pounding on white PVC pipes. The variety act began with just 3 guys, but as the show has expanded, so has the need for more blue men. Blake Farmer of member station WPLN reports on what it takes to become one.
Blue man casting directors know potential when they see it.
We're just going to check out your drumming.
My drumming
action.
Skills.
Yeah.
Okay. At an open call in Nashville, a would-be blue man stands across from a drumming instructor. A practice pad mounted on a chrome stand separates them.
Okay, I'm gonna speed up.
During the exercise, the other directors size him up, looking to see if he meets the height range of 5'10 to 6'1, athletic build. One whispers, too skinny.
That's all for me. Thank you.
Okay. That is simple as all get up. Thanks.
Thank you very much. We'll be making calls tonight to anyone that we want to see again.
Okay. Karen Rockauer says casting a show like The Blue Man Group is tricky. The concept itself is nearly impossible to explain.
We often describe the character as being a combination of someone's inner child and their inner hero. If you combine those two elements of yourself and remove your ego, that's your blue man.
Okay. The show consists of 3 guys with heads painted blue. The trio bang on pipes and drums and play with light and paint, all to a rocking soundtrack. They appear to be discovering everything around them, like cavemen.
You don't have to do a lot as a blue man. It's very, very simple. It's about what's going on internally for you, if you're connected to your, what we call an internal story.
My name is Tanner Jacobson, and I am here today pursuing a 12-year-long dream.
Jacobson tried out to be a blue man after seeing a show in New York. He was 18. The casting director said, go get a degree. He did one better. He got 2 and started on a PhD.
And now I'm back with a vengeance, ready to be blue for life.
Jacobson has been drinking. The blue Kool-Aid, that is.
It seems like the purest form of performance art you can possibly have, because all vanity, all the aesthetic is removed. You're completely concealed. It's an egoless, sexless character, and all he wants to do is create.
At callbacks, where reporters weren't allowed, casting directors wanted to see if the Blue Man wannabes had this and if they could tell a story with their eyes. They told 19-year-old Jesse Baker, a drummer by day, special effects artist by night, to respond to a few words with his face.
The first word was like, wow. So, of course, your first expression is, you know, you're almost like going to be in shock. Wow. But then it gets a little deeper and you're just like, wow.
It's like so subtle. But Blue Man Josh Elrod says physical storytelling is key to the show's global success.
People from every country in the world have come through New York and all laughed at the same moment.
Like when he catches 30 marshmallows in his mouth, a talent shared by all Blue Men.
So did you come into this thing being able to catch stuff in your mouth?
I did not, no. It's like the magic of showbiz, right? You're like, how do they do that? And then you very quickly learn, oh, it's just a lot of practice.
That's what Blue Man Boot Camp is for. For NPR News, I'm Blake Farmer in Nashville.
From Blue Man to blues over high gas prices.
Nice transition, Madeline.
Thank you, thank you. On this week's installment of Youth Radio's commentary series, What's the New What?, King Anye Howell talks about how gas prices are putting a damper on his social life.
What's the new what? I say gasoline is the new curfew. At 24 years old, I'm glad to say I don't have anyone setting a curfew for me. Instead, that someone has been replaced by a certain something. To be more specific, it's my gas tank. Since gas prices shot past $4 a gallon, my tank is the restricting factor whenever I want to bust out of the house. Over a month ago, on one of those all-too-rare nights when I did get out, I met a young lady.
I came out of a club, and you complimented my friend on her shoes.
And things just kind of went from there. That's Brianna Nuez. She lives 30 miles away from me in Pittsburgh, California. And with gas prices as high as they are, that might as well be a different state.
So how many times have we actually hung out?
You and I?
Yeah.
Once.
How many times do we talk? How much do we talk about hanging out?
Like every day.
Because gas costs so much, a lot of young folks across the nation feel like their fuel tanks are playing the role of fun police in their relationships. Let's take Portland, Maine, for example.
If I was going on a date, I think I'd be really traditional and have that person pick me up.
That's Christina Loring's strategy for saving gas money, going the traditionalist route. How convenient.
But I wouldn't hesitate to ride a bike to go downtown on a date.
Except that Christina says riding a bike makes it difficult for her to wear a dress or look as cute as she would if she were driving a car. And it's not just dates that gas prices have dampened. Miriam Archibong from Atlanta says people in her city used to be really into cruising.
You just drive and you have your music loud and you let people look at your car.
But now Atlanta youngsters are being forced to pump their brakes and apply some cruise control.
It's not a necessity, so people don't prioritize cruising anymore. We prioritize putting food on our table. We prioritize handling the basics. And cruising is not a basic need.
Back in California, a young lady called me up and pretended to prioritize hanging out with me. She asked if I could pick her up. I, in turn, asked her what she was willing to contribute to my gas tank to make that feasible. The conversation went downhill from there. Minutes later, she sent me a text message calling me a name I can't repeat on the radio. Let's just say jerk. But this only bothered me for a microsecond, because I reasoned to myself, hey, I'm the jerk with 5/8 of a tank of gas for tomorrow.
King Anye Howell is dateless but mobile in Oakland, California. Have gas prices affected your social life? You can weigh in on our blog. You don't have to spend a penny going anywhere. Just log on npr.org/daydreaming.